I thought I would talk a little bit about some of the things that I've done. And, you know, being an old codger now, talking to young students, I'm supposed to draw moral lessons from my life that you can then apply to your careers. I was a student with John Wheeler. He's the guy that gave black holes their names shortly before I went to work with him. And I learned some lessons from him, and I guess some of these I will try to convey how I applied them in my own career. So one of the things that I'm probably most known for is asking a question, namely, what is a particle? Now, one usually thinks in physics, in fact, we've got a whole subfield of physics called particle physics, which is nothing of the kind. Particles, ever since Newton, we think we know what they are, these little things that go wandering around, have a definite location in space and time, etc. Unfortunately, at the turn of the century, of the last century, when Einstein developed his theory of special relativity, he basically destroyed all of particle physics. The big problem is that if you want to have two particles interacting with each other, and you want to do it in a special relativistically invariant way, the only way you can do it is to have contact interactions. So one is, in a sense, going back to the Descartesian idea. Descartes believed that all forces, all influences of one thing to another had to come about because of direct contact between things. And this was one of the reasons why Newton's theory of gravity was such a revolutionary idea, because suddenly Newton was arguing that the gravitational force was something that could go from, let's say, the sun to one of the planets with nothing in between. It wasn't, in the Descartesian idea, the space was filled with some sort of fluid, and the sun, for somehow or other, produced these vortices in the fluid, and those vortices then went out and guided the planets around the sun. Suddenly you've got this thing which is a force which has nothing, no way of getting from one place to the other. So with Einstein's special relativity, one ran into the same kind of problem. And it, in a sense, wasn't really recognized, except that over the next 20 years or so, especially when quantum mechanics came in — again, quantum mechanics looks a lot like particle theory, and all the early quantum mechanics was, you know, particles and, you know, the Hamiltonians, etc. But as soon as one tried to unify that with special relativity, it all fell to pieces. And it took them about 20 years to really work their way through this, because they had the one great guiding theory, namely Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, as a guide to help them along their way. And by the late 1930s, early 1940s, all of particle physics had been replaced by what we now call field theory. The electromagnetic field — a field is something which sits, which has a value at every point in space. The values at one point in space influence the neighboring values via the usual equations of motion. And by 1950, all of physics was really quantum field theory, like quantum electromagnetism. But even things like protons and electrons and neutrons and all of these things that one usually thinks of as particles were replaced by fields. That there were these things who exist everywhere in space and have some equations of motion that tell how something at one point in space influences the neighboring guys. But then the question comes up, what's a particle? After all, we tend to think, and it doesn't seem to lead us into terribly great difficulties in terms of particles. In fact, it's gotten so bad that whenever you talk about, you know, something, you're always asking, what's the particle associated with it? Electromagnetism has the photon or the gluons or the protons or whatever, that there are these. But when you actually look at the theory that the people write down and do all your calculations in, they don't do that. They calculate these field theories, these wave equations for fields, etc. In the usual way of thinking about it, there are some technical ways in which one can take that field. One can look at the normal modes of that field, the set ways of vibration of that field. Then one can regard those normal modes as if they were quantum, as if they were simple harmonic oscillators. And we know that when we quantize a simple harmonic oscillator, one gets these energy states, 1/2 h bar omega, 1.5, 2.5, etc., these discrete energy levels that go up. So if we do that for the modes of the field, then we get these discrete packets of energy associated with each one of the modes, having energies of n times h bar omega plus 1/2 h bar omega. And those are the particles. But this is a really formal kind of definition. Also, since these modes generically are not localized objects, they're spread everywhere in space at once, this makes the particles seem like very non-localized kinds of things. And one of the things that bothered me was, because I was interested in black holes, was to ask the question about how in the world does one define particles when one's very near a black hole? In particular, Hawking had proposed that somehow black holes create particles. They're not completely black. How in the world does one define those particles when one gets very near the black hole? And so I was worrying about this. And it's one of the lessons you should draw. If you worry about something, take it seriously. Don't simply assume everybody else has thought about this, so therefore somebody must know the answer. I don't understand it, but somebody must, and so let me forget about it. Take your own worries, concerns seriously. Whenever you're in courses, the lecturer will always tell you, if you have a question, ask it. Because it's probable that there are loads of other students in the class as well that have the same question. Well, the same is true when you're doing research in physics. If you have a question, take it seriously for yourself and ask it. I mean, obviously you can't take all questions seriously because you don't have enough hours in the day or in your lifetime to do that. But, you know, take the question seriously and see what you can do with them. So my idea was, okay, let's ask, what is a particle? When one talks about particles, what does one do? One sets up a particle detector. Sounds a little bit tautological. But one sets up a cloud chamber, and you look for these little paths in the cloud chamber. Or one sets up a Geiger counter and you listen for the clicks in the Geiger counter. Or a photomultiplier tube and you look at those little pulses of voltage, etc., that are given off by the photomultiplier, etc. So perhaps my idea was we can use that in order to try and define what a particle is. Namely, as I now phrase it, and I didn't at that time, a particle is what a particle detector detects. Okay? Yes. Of course, that raises the issue of what in the world is a particle detector. And so you look around at your various particle detectors and you realize that they sort of have a common feature, namely that if there are no particles around, they just sit there and don't do anything. But if a particle comes along, it suddenly causes some sort of a transition inside the particle detector. In a cloud chamber, those little atoms suddenly get ionized. In a Geiger counter, the molecules of the air inside the Geiger counter get ionized. Then there's a huge voltage across the thing which accelerates those ions and produces a whole avalanche, etc. But the key thing is that you get the sudden transition between what's basically the ground state, the lowest energy state of the detector, and some excited state. So one can therefore define a particle detector as anything, let's say a particle inside a box, which has some lowest energy state, and you've all solved for, you know, the wave function of a particle inside a box. It has some wave function that looks like this, oscillating back and forth. And it has some higher energy states. You know, the next highest energy state might be something that looks like this. And again, it wiggles back and forth with some higher frequency with delta E equals H bar times the difference in frequency of those two states. So what would a particle detector be? Well, let's take this field, and to make things simple, instead of using an electromagnetic field, which has got a vector direction associated with it and has both an E field and a B field, it's sort of complicated. So why don't we just take something really simple, some field, it's usually called a scalar field, which simply has values at various points in space. Phi of t and x. And what we want to do is we want to couple this to the detector. Well, the detector is located at some location. And has a time that's associated with it, which I'll call tau. And you say, wait a minute, why are you calling it tau? You've already got a time t here. Well, we know that, for example, if that detector is moving, that its time is different from the time that you just get if you're sitting there. Special relativity tells us that. So what I want to do is I want to make this detector a sufficiently general object such that I could move it around. My own particular reason for that is that I knew that if you're sitting right near a black hole, you've got to be accelerating. Otherwise, you'd fall into the black hole. You need a big rope tied onto you to hold you outside the black hole. Well, that big rope has a tension in it which accelerates you. So let's think about a detector which is accelerated. And in that case, its time is going to be different from the background time that one might look at in the usual case. Well, we can now look at this quantum field, and we can, you know, and the detector is coupled to the quantum field at the position of the detector. What becomes important now is not the behavior of this quantum field as a function of the usual time, but as a function of the time of the detector. So the detector, for example, has a time dependence between the ground state and the first excited state, which looks like this. Sorry, this is tau. Now, I don't want to go through quantum field theory and give you a whole lesson in quantum field theory, so let me just state that if this were the ordinary time And you had this interaction between the detector and your quantum field going as e to the IE times t, then this operating on the vacuum state would give you identically equal to zero. So this would tell you that if you had this detector just sitting there in this room, that this detector would behave the way you wanted a detector to behave, namely that there, if there was nothing in the universe, if there were no particles associated with this quantum field, the detector wouldn't do anything. Because this operator, this quantum field operator acting on its on the vacuum, if I take the Fourier transform with respect to ordinary time, would just be equal to zero. But what happens if I don't have this detector just sitting there? Well, if I've got it in uniform motion, then it turns out that there's simply a linear relationship between this time and the ordinary time, and again, the Fourier transform. If this Fourier transform with t is zero, then if I make a linear transformation, the Fourier transform of that linear transform is still going to be zero. So even a uniformly moving detector won't see anything. But what happens if this is accelerated? Like it would be near the horizon of a black hole. Well, in that case, this t of tau becomes a, 1 over a, where a is the acceleration of the detector times sinh of a times tau. So this is what t is equal to, choosing my zero of my coordinate system appropriately. And the x of tau becomes 1 over a times cos a of tau. So I get this very, very, well, sort of looks like ugly dependence on tau coming in here. The important thing is that this Fourier transform operating on the vacuum is no longer equal to zero. In particular, what you find is that the state associated with this looks just as if you had a thermal state. In other words, this vacuum state, the thing that you usually, you know, that a particle detector sitting at rest there wouldn't see anything, once you start accelerating it, it starts clicking. It starts jumping up into its excited state. And it does it exactly at the rate that you would expect if you stuck it into a thermal bath, with a temperature proportional to the acceleration. Now, I haven't put any units in here. The temperature looks something like 1 over 2 pi times h bar times a divided by c times Boltzmann constant. And when you stick in all of those numbers, you find that to get a temperature of about 1 degree Kelvin, you need an acceleration of about 10 to the 22 centimeters per second squared. Yes?
Is it the motivation of choosing the coordinate system using the hyperbolic? Is there some sort of motivation to choose that sort of a coordinate?
To choose it, well, this coordinate, this choice of coordinates is exactly what you get if you have a uniformly accelerated path in special relativity. Yeah. So in special relativity, if you ask what happens if you uniformly accelerate something, that's what you get. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're holding something just outside a black hole, it's in uniform acceleration. So my interest was in asking what happens near the black hole. So this uniform acceleration seemed to be the sensible thing to have a look at. Yes?
From complete ignorance. I can see the t and tau part, but what's the interpretation of x when a is zero?
Well, I've chosen my coordinate system in order that this be true. In actual fact, there's an x0 in here, and one can always go ahead and take that x0 in such a way as to cancel out that 1 over a when you go to a equals 0. So it's just a uniformly accelerated guy is on a hyperbola, and I'm choosing my x and my t in such a way that the, what are they called? You know, when you have a hyperbola, these straight lines on the hyperbola are occurring at x equals 0 and t equals 0. So that's just my choice of coordinates. You could also do it, you know, sticking an extra x0, and it's not going to make any difference to the Fourier transform. Yes?
So this emission you see from far away?
No, this emission is the is being done by the detector. You're defining a particle, remember,
right,
as that which is detected by a particle detector. Okay? What's a particle detector? A particle detector is something with two energies, and the field whose particles you're trying to detect can cause transitions between those two levels. Well, that's exactly what you think of as a particle detector. You have a little photomultiplier, electromagnetic radiation comes in, it causes some transition of the electrons in that photomultiplier. So this is sort of a generic kind of detector. Yes? So we know, I mean, there is, you know, is this a complete theory of particle detectors? The answer is no, clearly not. But I know that regarding, you know, doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics seems to be a very good approximation. You know, Schrodinger equation for the hydrogen atom or something, pretending that there are really electrons circling the hydrogen atom with a nucleus, et cetera, in there, seems to be a very good approximation to whatever the full quantum field theory would say one should regard as a hydrogen atom. So what I'm using here is using that approximation and saying that that should be a reasonable approximation for this particle detector. And a suitably generic thing. I mean, remember what I said, is that a particle detector is something which generically is localized. In other words, it looks for particles here, not at Alpha Centauri. It's not spread out all over space. So it's a localized object. And it has two separate energy levels that the field can cause transitions between. And that's really all I need. Okay, there can be all kinds of other details. For example, a photomultiplier tube won't detect radio waves, right? They're just far too low a frequency to cause the transitions inside the photomultiplier, etc. And these are all sort of extra details that any real detector has, but are really not terribly relevant to this study, to this generic study. So this is the, I guess that's another lesson, is that, is try to simplify your problem to the maximum part. This is Einstein's thing. Try to make your problem as simple as you absolutely can, A, so you can solve it, but B, trying to make sure that it's not so simple that you've thrown out everything that's important. And I think this is true for this particular model of the particle detector. One would, of course, perhaps ultimately like a more detailed description of a particle detector. And one could imagine, for example, another possible particle detector would be a proton interacting with electrons and producing a neutron, right? The four-point interaction, it would also emit a neutrino in the process. But this could also be regarded as some sort of an electron detector, where it absorbs the electron, produces a neutrino, which has a slightly higher energy than the proton does. Yes?
Let's say your detector was generating electrons, say, as its detection of a particle. What would happen if you connected a cord to it that was the other end of the cord was in a reference frame that would have detected a vacuum state if that detector were in that frame.
Right.
Would the electrons reach that other frame, or would they disappear?
They could, or else, I mean, if you're not careful, of course, you tie a cord to your detector, that this thing is accelerating off and the cord breaks and then your whole detector doesn't work. But there's nothing that says that you can't have the little box that's going to click or whose dial is going to move. You can also have it accelerated, right? And you just watch with a telescope and you see the little needle move. Well, but the detector, I mean, it's the insides of the detector that are getting excited. Then that excited state of the detector does whatever it does. It's, for example, could be coupled to some other electronics, etc., which will then go ahead and ultimately move a dial. And you could have that whole thing traveling along with the particle detector. I mean, they're interesting questions. And you know, one of the things you can think about is to ask those kinds of questions and see whether or not they lead anywhere. And I've worried about them, and I don't think they lead anywhere, but, you know, all of this stuff could have been done in 1930, right? Somebody could have well done this in 1930 and gotten all of these results. Nobody did until the 1970s when I came along. They just hadn't looked at it in the way in which I did. And I may not be looking at something about this in the way in which would reveal some other neat features about it. So what we got was that the notion of particle is, in a sense, a relative notion. Namely, it depends on the motion, in this case, the acceleration of the detector. Another important thing is that particles manifest themselves in interactions. And what's really important about them is that they're coming about because of this transfer of energy between, in this case, the particle detector and the quantum field. The quantum field is what's important. That's what all physics is done in terms of. That's what you learn to do in order to calculate everything in, you know, modern so-called particle physics. You never actually do particle kinds of calculations. You're always doing field theory calculations. But they call it particle physics. Because usually the energies and the energy transfers are such that you really only get one or two of these particles. Or even, you know, in CERN, you might get 10,000 of them. Or 1,000 of them coming off one of these showers, but some small number of these particles, these transfers of energy, are taking place. So this, I mean, the main reason I talked about this is, A, I think it's a neat effect. Some people have asked whether this is simply an accident or some mathematical manipulation. And the answer is, I don't think so, because if you think about cooking your steak, right, and you would certainly say that the hot temperature for cooking your steak is some physical, real physical process. It's not some figment of your mathematical imagination, right? A cooked steak is different from an uncooked steak. Well, what happens when you cook a steak is the little molecules and atoms inside that piece of steak absorb radiation and change from one state to another. The little protein guys, you know, either get broken apart or else they join up into longer polymers, toughening your steak, etc. the surface gets browned because they absorb too many, you know, too much energy, and those molecules got broken apart into their constituent carbon, etc. Well, that's exactly the same kind of thing as happening here. So that tells you that if you took your steak and you accelerated it hard enough, you should be able to cook it. And surely a cooked steak, you know, going from a non-cooked steak to a cooked steak is real physics. I mean, that's not something that's just a mathematical transformation. Of course, you know, as I said, 1 degree Kelvin is 10 to the 22 or something centimeters per second squared. So that's what, 10 to the 19 G. So getting up to 300 Kelvin, which is, you know, what you usually like to cook your steak at, or say 500 Kelvin, is going to take a slightly higher acceleration. So you're up in the 10 to the 20 G's kind of thing, and your steak might get a little bit squashed. But, you know, that's just an engineering difficulty. But the reason I wanted to do this was precisely to demonstrate that, you know, it's important to take your questions. In this case, it seemed like a completely almost silly question. You know, what is a particle in modern particle physics? You know, it seems to be in the title already, but it turned out not to be. And, you know, what is a particle? And then thinking about how in the world does one measure? How does one determine that one has a particle there? One does measurements. And keeping measurements in mind in physics is always a really, really good idea. It's really easy to get, especially as a theorist, to get drowned in the mathematics and to, you know, sit there manipulating all of these symbols that you got taught in your courses, like the ones you're going to get in the next year or so. Part of it is just learning how to manipulate those symbols, but constantly thinking about the physics behind them, and in particular the measurements behind them. How in the world are these effects actually measured? And unfortunately, few enough physicists do that, that if you spend your time thinking in that way, you often can find things that other people miss. Another thing I wanted to talk about was, again, this refers to this whole black hole evaporation business. So in 1974, Stephen Hawking showed that black holes have a temperature. One had always thought about black holes before that as black. You know, stuff goes in, nothing can come out. That's more or less the definition of a black hole. You can throw radiation in, nothing comes out. Suddenly in 1974, Stephen said, well, if you take quantum mechanics into account, stuff seems to not come out, but at least be generated from right near around the black hole. There seems to be some sort of funny quantum instability right near the black hole that produces thermal radiation proportional to, what is it, 8 pi h bar gm over c cubed. Oops, Boltzmann constant in here as well. A temperature like that. For a solar mass black, for a solar gm over c cubed is a time. What am I doing? I got it just the wrong way around. Gm over c cubed is a time, so 1 over a time is a frequency. H bar times a frequency is an energy, divided by Boltzmann constant is a temperature. And 8 pi is just, you know, some number of order unity. So this was a surprise. And it's a surprise that we still don't understand. And it was partly in an attempt to understand that, because he said there are these particles created, and I wanted to know where in the world are these particles created. Then I had to figure out what particle was. Then I discovered that if you accelerate a particle detector, it produces loads and loads of, it looks as though it's immersed in loads and loads of particles. And as I get closer and closer to the horizon, there are more and more particles, it seems, there already. So I never did actually answer the question as to where these particles got created, because when I lower the particle detector closer by to try and see these particles being created, they just got swamped out by all of these particles that were there because of the acceleration of the detector. So one of the questions is, what causes this? And for a long time, I and most other people thought that this was something which was peculiar to black holes, that only black holes behaved in this way. But unbeknownst to me, already 3 years before this, my mind had been wandering off on a separate track. I was asked to give a colloquium at Oxford on black holes. These were early days of black holes. And I was trying to think of some way of explaining black holes to them. And the analogy I came up with was basically a waterfall analogy. Let's imagine that we've got water flowing over a waterfall. Flowing slowly here, flowing very rapidly here. And in particular, there's some point, let's say there, where the velocity of water exceeds the velocity of sound. Actually, on Earth, the water has to fall about 10,000 kilometers before the velocity of the water exceeds the velocity of sound. But that's, again, an engineering detail. We can pretend we're living in Discworld. I don't know if any of you have read Terry Pratchett. But there, everything moves more slowly. And this world has got some physicist fish in it. These are blind fish, but they have ears. So they experience the world through sound. And what happens to sound waves as you get near this surface? Well, the sound is traveling against the flow of the water. So sound waves out here will gradually get out. Sound that's traveling with the flow of the water is going to travel faster, and sound that's traveling against the flow is going to travel more slowly. What about sound that's emitted just here? Well, the sound waves that's traveling directly outwards never gets anywhere because the water is flowing at exactly the same rate as the sound is trying to get out. So the successive surfaces of sound are going to look something like this. And it's going to take longer and longer for the sound to get out the closer you get to this surface. Well, many of these features are exactly what happens in a black hole. As you get near the black hole, it takes longer for light to get out of the black hole. Exponentially longer, just like here. If, for example, he's a professor and here's a little graduate student fish who got a little bit too close, and just as he's starting to fall through the horizon, the sonic horizon, he yells, "Help!" Well, anyone who's falling more or less with him will hear him calling, "Help!" But the successive sounds coming out in that word will take longer and longer to come out. the frequency will get base shifted, and as a result, quieter. And all the professor will hear is, help! Because the P never got out, it was emitted by the time the graduate student fell through that surface. And this is, in fact, one of the key characteristics of black holes. If you drop something into a black hole and you look at the light from it, that light gets redshifted so that you never actually see the object go into the black hole, just as you never hear this little fish fall through that horizon. He, of course, does fall through the horizon in a very short period of time, just like something falling into a black hole falls in a very short period of time. So there's a lot of features of this which look like black holes, and that's why I wanted to use it as an analogy in giving my lecture. That's sort of all it was, until about 8 years later, I was preparing some lecture notes. I was teaching a course on fluid mechanics, and while preparing my notes for my undergraduates, I sat there, you know, my part of my mind was wandering off elsewhere, and I started thinking, well, okay, let's try and actually do some calculations. What are the equations of motion of these sound waves in the vicinity of this horizon? And when you do that, you find that the equations of motion for the sound waves in the vicinity of that horizon are exactly the same as the equations of motion for one of these scalar fields in the vicinity of a black hole. Absolutely identical equations. In the black hole case, one has a metric. It turns out that there's an effective metric for the sonic case as well. And that effective metric determines the equations of motion for those sound waves. One can now imagine quantizing those sound waves. Well, condensed matter physicists do that all the time. They call them phonons, little particles of sound waves, if you will. But they're really quantizing the sound wave field. If we quantize them, that quantization is exactly the same as the quantization of the scalar field around a black hole. In particular, you can go through Hawking's calculation step by step, and every single step works. What does that imply? That implies that one of these horizons, one of these sonic horizons, should also produce thermal radiation, just like a black hole does. I titled the paper Experimental Black Hole Evaporation? Question mark, because I wasn't sure. Maybe this was some way where one could actually do experiments on horizons, not of black holes, of course. Black holes are really hard to find. And most of them are so huge, solar mass or bigger, and the temperature of a solar mass black hole would be about 10 to the minus 5 Kelvin. And it's really hard to see 10 to the minus 5 Kelvin from a body that's a few kilometers across, immersed in the 3-degree background radiation. But maybe one could do this for these sound waves and set up an experiment where one could actually see the radiation given off by this horizon. Now, this idea seemed to have these 10-year gaps in them, because I didn't know what to do with this until about 10 years later. Ted Jacobson, one of the things about sound waves is we know that you can't have a sound wave whose wavelength is smaller than the distance between atoms. And one of the questions I raised was, does that destroy the effect? If that destroyed the effect, then one wouldn't have much faith in the black hole case, because surely once one gets down to very, very short distances, these, you know, the nice equations of motion for the scalar field break down. Once you get frequencies of the scalar field whose frequency are much bigger, h bar times that is much bigger than the mass of the whole universe, that doesn't propagate just like a nice non-interacting scalar field in the vicinity of that poor black hole. Something coming in with the mass of the whole universe is going to perturb the black hole rather severely. So here we have a way in which you get funny things happening at short wavelengths, and one can ask whether or not that destroys the effect. It took about 10 years. Ted Jacobson came up with the crucial idea that the key thing that the dispersion relation, that the atomic nature of the fluid does is to change the dispersion relation, the relation between frequency and wavelength. Usually, you know, wavelength equals frequency. Wavelength times frequency equals the velocity of sound or velocity of whatever wave that you've got there. That relationship gets altered once one gets to very short wavelengths. And numerical calculations that I and Jacobson and his students did in the 90s indicated that one still got this thermal radiation. And then about 2 years ago, a group at UBC actually did an experiment like this, in which instead of using sound waves, we used surface waves, and we had water flowing over an obstacle. The water would flow more rapidly across the obstacle on top of it than out here. And if you arrange things properly, if one looks at surface waves in the water, this water is flowing faster than those surface waves. One gets a horizon, and one can do experiments. One can send these surface waves at the horizon and see what happens in the vicinity of the horizon. And we found that it behaves exactly as though you had a temperature. In this case, we couldn't measure the temperature directly. It was about 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin, and our water is warmer than that, at least in Vancouver. Sometimes in Waterloo, it feels like it's close to that. But we found that, in fact, one would expect to get quantum emission in our experiments from right near that horizon. So again, you can see that there's this sort of funny progression. It started off just as an analogy, you know, a nice little picture that you can use to describe to a naive audience what it is that you're thinking about. That analogy suddenly became, when I started taking it seriously, suddenly became much deeper and sufficiently deep that one actually could go ahead and start to do experiments to try and see the thermal radiation from a horizon and see that it really was thermal, had a thermal spectrum. So take your questions seriously. Take your thoughts, your analogies seriously. You obviously can't take all of them seriously, but take the ones that you're most interested in seriously. And very often, you suddenly come up with ideas that nobody else has had. They should have. That one was there already in 1930. You know, some of the giants of, you know, Bohr and all of those guys had all of the tools necessary for finding that. They didn't, because they weren't thinking about it or asking the question in quite the right way. And the same kind of thing happens to you. One of the problems always is that you look at the field of physics, so many people working in it, so much thought has gone into it. God, what can I do? I mean, how in the world can I ever find a niche for myself? And the answer is take yourself, take your ideas, take your questions seriously, and usually you find it. There's a famous saying of William Blake from his Marriage of Heaven and Hell that I've, in a sense, taken as my motto, and that is, if the fool would persist in his folly, he would become wise. In other words, take yourself seriously, even if it seems stupid. Take your question seriously, and things can happen. Anyway, I don't have anything else to say, so if there are any questions, yes. It turns out that they're very, very closely related to each other. In other words, If you take a particle detector and lower it into a black hole, so here you've got a black hole and here you've got the particle detector. When it's far away from the black hole, it just sees this thermal radiation coming out of the black hole from some place. You know, the black hole is a small object over there. So, you know, like the sun in the sky, there's a hot little region there which is radiating towards you. As you lower the box towards the black hole, you're getting closer. The radiation source is getting bigger and bigger in the sky. But again, it looks like this thermal radiation is coming in. Because of the gravitational redshift, the farther, you know, when you're far away, it's some temperature. As you get closer, that temperature gets higher. It gets blue shifted. So, you know, the photon has to climb its way out of the gravitational field. It loses energy in the process, etc. So it has a longer wavelength when it's far away than when it's close. Once you get around R equals 3m, g over c squared, stick that in there. R equals 2m is the horizon. And I won't put the g over c squared in that one. Once you get around here, there's this transition that happens. This black hole now starts to seem like it's covering the whole sky. Photons from incoming from here come into the back of the detector as well as to the front. And at about this point, you get a smooth transition over to the acceleration radiation. So when you're in this regime, the radiation can best be described as that acceleration radiation. When you're far away, it looks like this horizon of the black hole is this hot body, which is radiating out towards you. And that trans, I mean, obviously not, this is not a sharp region, but in the region around R equals 3m is where you get this transition between that radiation looking like acceleration radiation to looking like the Hawking radiation from far away. This turned out to be extremely important. Throwing away all 2 pi's, etc. Remember, thermodynamics says TdS equals dE. And since E equals mc squared, that's equal to dm. T is 1 over m. So you get dS equals m dm, which is m squared. That turns out to just be the surface area of the black hole. If you put in the suitable numbers, you get K Boltzmann times 1/4 times the area. So black holes seem to have an entropy. Jacob Bekenstein already realized or suspected this for no very good reasons before Hawking stuff came out. The problem was that Bob Guroche pointed out a problem with this. Namely, let's imagine a little machine where I fill a box full of radiation. I lower the box down to the horizon of the black hole. In the process, there's a huge tension in the rope. So I extract the energy from that radiation in the box via the work that that tension does. And when you do the calculation, you find that if you lower it right to the horizon, you can extract all of its energy. Now you extract all of that energy. Obviously, you're not extracting the entropy. This is work. So the work has no entropy. It does not heat flux. You can now open the box and drop the radiation inside the box into the black hole. You get rid of its entropy. You've extracted all of its energy, so therefore the mass of the black hole doesn't change, and the entropy of the black hole doesn't change. So I've got a little heat engine here in which I can extract all of the energy at zero cost and decrease the entropy of the system. Well, that's supposed to be that's a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. What's wrong? The answer is that when you get near the horizon, it's accelerating like mad. It sees itself surrounded by a thermal bath. And Archimedes taught us what happens when you stick a body into a thermal bath. It feels a buoyant force. That one didn't. It feels a buoyant force. That buoyant force reduces the tension in the rope. All you can do is to lower that box to the point at which it will float. After that, you've got to do work on it to push it down in. So you can't extract all of the energy because of this thermal radiation that's there due to the acceleration. You can't extract all of the energy. And when you go through the calculation, you find that that means that the entropy of the black hole increases by an amount which is greater than or equal to the amount of entropy inside the box. Second law of thermodynamics is saved. It's saved because of this relationship between the acceleration, which gives the buoyant force, and the Hawking radiation, which implies the entropy of the black hole. So yes, there's a close relationship between the two.
Surface gravity here, and the event horizon, and would you get exactly the Hawking radiation?
If...
Let's see if you find for observer, stay at the event horizon.
Right. Right at the event horizon, the observer is infinitely accelerated, and he'll see an infinite temperature. But the redshifting of that temperature as you take it away from the horizon out to far away gives you exactly the Hawking temperature. So they are, in fact, so the acceleration right near the horizon is, through the redshift, intimately related to the Hawking temperature as seen from far away.
So are these two kind of the same temperature?
Well, when you're very near the horizon, it's a very, very high temperature, right? Because the acceleration goes to infinity. But when you translate that out via the redshift, you find that it's exactly the same as the Hawking temperature. They're identical. So the acceleration radiation near the horizon just smoothly goes over to the Hawking radiation very far away from the horizon. And yeah, so they are in fact extremely closely related to each other. If one didn't have the acceleration radiation, one would be able to violate the second law of thermodynamics with black holes. So that would have been another way of deriving that. In fact, nobody came up with that. Instead, Bekenstein introduced a new law of physics, which said that there was a maximum entropy that any box could hold, given by the dimensions of the box. Which may be true, but this argument says it's certainly not necessary in order to rescue the second law of thermodynamics for black holes. Anyway, so that's a quick tour of, you know, some of the interesting things I've done in physics. And with little morals attached to them so that I can hand them to you guys. I hope at least, if even if the morals aren't interesting, that the story might have been a little bit interesting.